This is May 20th, 1988, talking to Reynolds Price at the Algonquin Hotel. I want to congratulate you. You were inducted to the American Academy of Arts and Letters, if I have that correct.
Academy and Institute.
Yeah, yes. Something like that. I always forget. And I understand they had a big banquet uptown. What was that like?
It was a very pleasant occasion, including a number of American writers, artists, and composers. Nice to see a lot of old friends and to meet some new writers whom I've admired for years but hadn't known.
I see your fellow Duke graduate, William Styron, was also inducted.
Yes, he was inducted into the Academy, and James Dickey, who's an old friend of mine from South Carolina, the poet, was inducted at the same time.
What do you have to do? Are there any demands on you once you're inducted?
No demands whatever, as far as I understand. There's various prize committees and so forth that one can serve on if he wants. Basically, it's simply an acknowledgement of past work.
So what happens at the banquet?
It was a luncheon, and then there's a sort of prize day ceremony afterwards, rather like prize days anywhere. There's a speech, which this year was given by Mario Vargas Llosa, the Peruvian novelist. And there are various prizes given and various other shorter speeches. I'd attended the ceremony several times in the past, so was familiar with the form of it.
Well, let's talk about you and your work. I guess the timing of the Academy's induction was pretty good, because it came at about the same time that Good Hearts came out. There's something reassuring about reading Good Hearts and coming across familiar names, familiar people that were in earlier novels, knowing that they live, and they grow older, and they exist, and they survive, and sometimes they do well, sometimes not so well. But Good Hearts is really a continuation of the saga of this particular family, isn't it? Tell me about it.
It's, I think, a completely independent novel that doesn't require a reader to have any knowledge of any prior work, but it in fact, centers upon a married couple named Rosa and Wesley Beavers, who live in Raleigh, North Carolina, in the mid-1980s. They are the central figures of my first novel, which was published in 1962, called A Long and Happy Life. At that time, in the first novel, they were 20 and 22 years old. Now they are 48 and 50, and they are in the long midst of a marriage that, like so many marriages in their middle ages, has really, in a sense, run out of impetus, run out of apparent reason for continuance. And Wesley, the husband, does what's becoming a sadly familiar thing, which is simply not return home from work one evening. And the remainder of the novel develops from that disappearance of his, where he goes, what he does while he's gone, what happens to Rosa in his absence, what brings him back suddenly, and what they decide to do about this ruptured marriage.
It's kind of interesting to look back to see how these characters developed, because I believe you were studying in England at the time that you hit upon these characters. Tell me about the inception.
Well, actually, the inception of the character of Rosa, whose full name is Rosa Koch, her maiden name is Rosa Koch Muschin, she appeared first in the first long short story I ever wrote, which I wrote as an undergraduate at Duke University in 1955. Then when I went straight on to graduate school in England in about 1957, I suddenly, again, without ever thinking that I'd revert to this character, I found myself imagining the plot of a novel containing the same woman and the young man she'd been in love with for some time, Wesley Beavers. So I began making notes for that and began writing it in 1958, finished it in 61, and it was published in 62 as A Long and Happy Life. In 66, I published my second novel called A Generous Man, which was in fact really centered on Rosa's brother, or her older brother, Milo. Though Rosa herself is in the novel, it's primarily about her brother. many, many years passed in which I didn't think about the family and didn't write anything about them, nor plan to write anything about them. And then about 2 years ago, when I was attempting to begin a new novel that I wanted to center upon a particular man's voice, I suddenly found that the idea of this story volunteered in my mind much more strongly than the project I thought I had planned for myself next. So I sat down and rather quickly wrote the novel that's now published as Good Hearts.
I think your readers should also note that the Mustian, am I pronouncing it correctly,
yes.
Mustian? The Mustian saga has been put together as a single book. I believe it's called Mustian.
It's called Mustian, yes. It's available as a paperback, Valentine paperback.
So they can read almost everything chronologically in the
yes.
family, can't they?
Yes. It's two novels and a short story all about various members of the Mustian family.
Now, tell me about your early days. Was there something in your childhood or your family that propelled you into this literary obsession? If that's the correct word, I think that's probably safe.
yeah, there were a number of things. No one in the family was a writer. They wrote nothing more extensive than letters, so they wrote a great many of those in that glorious day before the telephone consumed all of our lives. But both my families, my father's and my mother's, they were large extended families, all of whom lived around in the same county and around their birthplaces. Was still there throughout my childhood in very good health. And they were people who, in fairly typical, classic family fashion, spent a great deal of time talking about the family history, about the life of the community. Because they didn't read a great many books, basically only the local newspaper, their chief subject of thought and talk was the family. So I was immersed as a child in this endless bath of family talk, family legend, family story, family lying. And I was the child who wasn't bored by it, but who was fascinated by it and always preferred listening to that to listening to other children. I think that my origin as a writer must lie somewhere in that fascination with the adult tale-telling in the family.
So let me make one check. For the Rosa Koch and the others in your series, I hesitate to call it a series, but in effect it has become, did you draw on your own family for these characters?
I didn't draw on my own family for these particular characters. These characters come from a stratum of North Carolina rural society, which would be slightly below that of my own family. These are people who started life as relatively small farmers. Both my parents' families were good upper middle class families without any large amount of money, but very comfortably off and not presently engaged in working on the land, though my mother's family had been farmers a generation earlier than her own parents. My father's family had not been in farming for a very long time. His grandfather in Warren County had been a cabinet maker. Then his own father had worked in a courthouse and a clerk's job for many years. So the Mustians and the Beavers families are tobacco farmers who live out in the county. They're the kinds of people whose children I went to junior high school with when I lived in Warrenton for 3 years in the late 1940s. And that's really the only time in my life that I had close contact with people from that particular stratum of small farming life.
One thing I noticed with Good Hearts as compared to the earlier books, I guess this goes with our newer freedoms, our more permissive society in terms of expression, but there's a lot of more explicit sex in Good Hearts than in the earlier books. But I guess this is a reflection of the times. Is that not true?
Well, I think it's hardly explicit sex in any extremely X-rated basis. But
I didn't mean to imply that. But compared to the earlier books.
Yeah, Well, I think it is, in fact, a function of what's happened in American publishing in the more than 25 years since the first novel was published, and even the second Western novel.
I mean, you did depict Wesley, for example, masturbating as he is driving on that wheel.
Those are things that were far from common in American fiction, certainly in mainline American fiction in the 1960s. I think they've just rather rapidly it's become apparent to us that it's possible to talk about at least those aspects of sexual life which a writer thinks are genuinely revealing of a particular character's life. And I think that kind of solitary self-involvement that Wesley shows in that particular scene says a great deal about his own particular kind of loneliness. It's hardly there as a gratuitous piece of sexuality.
Now, when you went to Duke, what did you... You had planned to be a teacher?
Yes, I from the time I was really about a junior in high school, in fact, it was from my junior year in high school, I really knew rather suddenly and simultaneously that I wanted to be both a writer and a teacher. I had been terrifically influenced by a wonderful woman named Phyllis Peacock in Broughton High School in Raleigh, North Carolina that year, who had encouraged me greatly as a writer and who herself was a marvelous teacher. So the two things simply came together for me in one model person, and I made up my mind at that point that that's what I wanted to be, and I went about trying to become it.
But, of course, there are various levels of teaching. Had you expected to teach on a college level at some point?
I don't think at that point in my life I'd really thought through where I would teach. In those days in America, the late 1940s, early 50s, teaching was a much more free-form activity than it is now. One didn't have to have quite such elaborate credentials, and jobs weren't as difficult to find as they are now. So I had not really particularly defined, though by the time I got into college at Duke University, a few years later, I definitely knew that I wanted to teach in a university somewhere.
When you left Duke, you went on to Oxford. What was that like? Was that a culture shock, coming from the South and going to this bastion of intellectual society?
It was something of a shock, basically a pleasant shock. It took me a little while to get used to the terrific differences between the English educational system and our own. The English system leaves virtually everything up to the goodwill and motivation of the particular student, and the student is watched much less and monitored much less by senior figures in the university. So it takes a little while for almost any American to realize that, gee, they're not making me do anything, but I'd better get busy and start doing things. No, I loved it. I was there for 3 years and went back for a fourth year later. Managed to do a great deal of writing at the same time that I was doing my graduate work, but it was a thoroughly pleasant time in my life.
What happened after Oxford?
Came back to teach at Duke, which, as a matter of fact, was a piece of luck that I assumed was going to be temporary. I was there in Oxford in my third year, beginning to think that I had to start making job applications and realizing how difficult it was going to be to apply for jobs from 3,000 miles away, when suddenly my old undergraduate college, Duke, wrote to me and offered me a 3-year contract as an instructor to teach freshman and sophomore English. It seemed the easy way out, and I knew it was a pleasant place to be, and I had a number of friends who were still there teaching, and so I went, not very much thinking that I'd wind up spending the next 30 years teaching there, but they made me welcome, and I liked being there, so I've been there ever since for one semester a year.
So outside of that period in Oxford, you've never left the South, have you?
No, except for 4 years. I've lived right there in North Carolina, within about 75 miles of my birthplace. I've traveled very widely in America and in the world, but never really lived anywhere else for more than those years in England.
Now, as you began teaching, you obviously continued your writing and you successfully published your work, but when you started out, obviously nobody heard of Reynolds Price. You had small-town characters, well, not necessarily, I guess, small-city characters in some respects. How does a young writer, such as yourself from the South, become published? What happens?
Very early, as a matter of fact, when I was still a senior in college, Eudora Welty came to Duke to give a lecture. I didn't know her at the time, but my writing teacher showed her a story of mine, which she liked, and asked if she could show it to her New York agent, a man named Dermot Russell, who's now dead but was a very famous agent. He took me on as his client, though I only had one short story at that point. Soon thereafter, I had another, the Rosa Coke story. He circulated those stories for 3 or 4 years in America while I was at Oxford, and there were no takers. But eventually, Stephen Spender, who then edited a magazine in London called Encounter, took the Rosa Coke story and published it in London in 1958, which was my last year of my first go-round in England. And as soon as it appeared in Encounter, Encounter at that point also had a large American readership, I began to get number of letters from American editors and publishers asking if I had a novel, which I didn't. I had about 3/4 of a volume of short stories at that point, so most of them collapsed in their interest when they heard about short stories. But Hiram Hayden, who at that time was editor-in-chief at Random House, gave me a contract. And by the time I had finished what I thought was to be the last story in a volume of stories, it had turned into a novel. And Hiram Hayden had left Random House and was one of the co-founders of Athenaeum. So I went there with him, and it was published there as a novel.
And you've been with Athenaeum ever since, haven't you?
Been with Athenaeum ever since, yeah. It's been a 26-year association.
I understand that agents just won't try to sell short stories today. That was unusual, or maybe that was customary at the time you wrote those stories.
There must be some agents who are circulating short stories, but the world does seem to be demanding fewer and fewer stories. It's certainly in magazines of national circulation, there are only about 3 magazines left which publish short stories as a matter of policy. The New Yorker and Esquire and Atlantic are about it, really.
Most of these stories are published in the little magazines or university presses.
Yes, there are dozens of little magazines throughout the country, varying in quality from excellent to mediocre, and that's been classically, not just now, but I think always in American publishing, where writers have had their beginnings. A number of my first pieces were published in very small magazines, and the interesting thing is that, and the rather surprising thing is that good New York editors still keep up with the best of those little magazines, and students of mine now who have their early stories published in some small journal edited, let's say at Washington and Lee University, will find that they might get a letter from an editor at Knopf for Athenaeum saying that they'd seen the story and would be interested in seeing something else.
Indeed. There's a young writer whose book called, can't remember the title, but it's on the bestseller list. Ethan Kanan is his name. Emperor of the Air, it's called. It's a collection of short stories. And published by Houghton Mifflin. Ethan is 26 and a medical student at Harvard. And an editor at Houghton Mifflin saw one of his stories and wrote him a letter saying, we'd like to publish a book by you. Mm-hmm. He didn't have a book, but he had one other story that he'd written when he was at Iowa. And I think he wrote 3 other stories. So he could flesh out this book. It's only about 170 pages. But it got rave reviews, and it's on the bestseller list today. So it does happen, doesn't
it? It's a fairly common. Young writers obviously all want to be published first in the New Yorker or Esquire or the Atlantic, but it can't happen. It happens very, very seldom. But if they can get published in a good, respectable literary quarterly, they're very lucky, and they're likely to be seen. The talent scouts are combing the country looking for, after all, despite the great glut of books and the impossible-seeming number of writers in America, publishers are still very hungry for first-class writers. There are not many of them.
Well, I was reading a book by John Boswell a week or two ago called The Awful Truth About Publishing, and he was giving advice about how to get your manuscript published and what kind of books to write. One of the things he said was, don't write fiction. He says 90% of anything submitted to a publishing house in terms of fiction is rejected. He said it's better to come up with a nonfiction book or some unusual offering, but fiction, he says, avoid it. It's too hard. Most people just can't pull it off. And it is hard. You're talking about a nonfiction book. At least there are elements there that you can research and put down. And there's almost a form for it. But with fiction, that is a whole different ballgame, because it comes out of your psyche, your religion, your parents, your family. It's an incredible creative process that remains a mystery, isn't it, the creation of fiction?
It's pretty mysterious, but I would disagree with Boswell. I would think if a given writer is really driven to write fiction, really wants to write fiction, and if that writer, he or she, is really good, there's no question that he or she will be published by a good publisher. I don't know, after 30 years of watching American publishing, as difficult as it is, I don't know of a single really first-class fictional manuscript which is circulated in New York for a year, which hasn't been accepted by a good publisher. There are an awful lot of unpublished novels and abandoned novels in drawers all over America, but if you'll read them and stop listening to the writer's claim that he's an neglected genius, you'll find that it's not a very good manuscript. All the good ones that I know of ultimately are published, so it may take a waiting period of somewhere from a year to a year and a half.
Or longer. Ironweed, William Kennedy's Ironweed,
right.
It was several years, in fact.
Exactly.
Of course, there were problems there, I think, as the editor left, and there were other problems than the manuscript alone, I think,
yeah.
With regard to that book.
Right. And he had, in fact, published books before that, but just to speak of first, of unknown writers, I think the chance of a really first-class unknown writer is not getting noticed is very slim indeed.
I was talking to Malcolm Bossy a while ago. He wrote his best-known book is called The Warlord, about China. And he has written a lot of books, and he says that his closet is filled with manuscripts, because he would write a novel, submit it, he would get the novel back, and the publisher would say, or the editor would say, well, this isn't for us, or it's not very good, and he would accept that. And so these manuscripts piled up in his closet, and they're still there. And I said to him, how do you know that some of these manuscripts aren't good, simply
exactly.
because one editor says they're not?
Exactly.
Sometimes perhaps a writer has to have faith in his own work.
Completely so. I just read in a review of the new biography of Salinger yesterday that The Catcher in the Rye was rejected by a famous American trade publisher because one particular editor in the house didn't like it, didn't think it would appeal to prep school audiences. And that editor was a textbook editor in the house, not even a trade fiction editor. So there are famous examples. Every house has its famous case of the one that got away. But that's why I say if a novel persists, or the author persists, or the agent persists in submitting it long enough, it's going to find its place. I literally don't know of a single unpublished genius, despite what numbers of people and numbers of bars will tell you.
Now, your work has accelerated in the last few years. You came down with a crippling disease. Tell me how that happened and how that has affected you in your work.
In 1984, I discovered that I had a very large malignant tumor in my spinal cord. It had not produced recognizable symptoms up to the point by which time it was a very large tumor. And with the technology available in 1984, they were unable to remove the tumor from the cord without leaving me quadriplegic, and so they relied on 5.5 weeks of radiation, which were very withering, and I think which in themselves, though they stopped the tumor in its tracks for a while, they damaged the cord further. And very shortly thereafter, I was paraplegic, which I remain, and presumably will remain until they learn how to reconnect damaged spinal tissue. However, I had the great luck that a couple of years after that first abortive attempt to remove the tumor, an ultrasonic laser scalpel was placed in the hands of neurosurgeons, and they were able to go back in at Duke University Hospital and remove the tumor, so that now I'm basically without spinal tumor, or appear to be, and have enormous amounts of time and energy that I didn't have before when I led a normal, busy outdoor life. I now have all those things done for me by kind friends, or most of them done for me by kind friends, and so I take all of that time and that energy, and I stay home and behave myself and write books. So the work has been coming thicker and faster than it did before.
So you're saying, in effect, there are fewer distractions.
There are fewer distractions. There's a lot more quiet time at home. And luckily, I've been able to... I was always a fairly good concentrator, and I've been able to take all that quiet time and not go crazy and sit down and write books with it.
How did this affect you emotionally? It would seem to me that some people would just stop in their tracks and say, hey, this is it.
Well, I think it's very devastating in the early stages, the total shock of discovering that something's been with you for months, perhaps long years, that you didn't know about, some kind of enemy within your own gates, terrorist within your own city. In my own case, there were about 5 months of shock and some depression, understandably, the normal, realistic, reactive depression. And I was unable to work during that time. I had started a novel of mine called Kate Vaden and had been unable to continue with it. Had written about a third of it and had been unable to continue after the tumor was discovered. But at the end of that 5 months, I was commissioned to write a play. And I thought, well, maybe this is a message from the sky. So I dived in and found that I could write a play. And then as soon as I'd written the play, I found that the machine was cranked in my head, and I went ahead and went back and finished Kate Vaden very rapidly, and have since been writing quite regularly.
But you're glad you finished Kate Vaden.
Very glad. Kate Vaden is one of my own favorite books, and certainly was one of the most popular books I've ever published.
You said something a moment ago about something coming from the sky to let you know that you should continue. What impact does religion have on your work?
I've always been a deeply religious person. I've never been a very churchly person. I was christened in the Episcopal Church in my childhood, attended churches until I was an undergraduate in college, and gradually drifted away from them, primarily, I think, drifted away because of the racist attitude of Southern white churches in my early youth, childhood and early youth. Since then, don't have a regular relationship with a church, but I certainly continue to have very regular relations with the sky, as I called it earlier.
Now, you are in a wheelchair, but you seem to have adapted. The very fact that you're in the Algonquin Hotel in New York shows that you're not afraid to leave home. How is you are still getting around pretty well?
Yeah, I've grown very strong in my trunk as a result of all the pushing and lifting that I have to do. I'm very fortunate to have an excellent assistant. I've had three assistants now who've lived with me each for a year at a time and do for me those things which I can't safely do for myself. Airlines make it quite easy for paralyzed people to fly. They're, in fact, very helpful indeed. So I went into a very good rehab unit at Duke Hospital a year after this situation landed in my life and learned all of the many, many techniques that are known now, have been developed for dealing with severe physical impairments. So while I don't recommend paraplegia to anyone who's out there looking for life's work, there are a great many ways to capitalize upon whatever benefits may come along with it. And in my own case, I really think all the benefits of all this new energy and work were genuinely unpredictable in my life before the age of 51 when this happened.
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with your arms.
Nothing wrong with my arms, whatever.
You consider it a typewriter. Or
yes.
What do you use?
Well, I use a word processor, an IBM, and love it. I had only begun that a year before the initial first surgery, so I was well primed for writing at a keyboard and have continued to do so.
You're still teaching at Duke, you said, a quarter?
I teach one semester a year, always generally in the spring semester, and I teach a literature course annually. Generally, I teach the poetry of John Milton. And then I teach a creative writing course of some sort or other. This past semester, I taught short story writing.
Tell me about the students who attend your creative writing course. What are they writing about these days?
Well, interestingly, they're not writing about the sorts of things young people wrote about really right on up through, I would say, the mid-70s. Up to that point, students, young writers, classically wrote about the young writer's subjects, growing up, relations with parents, grandparents, first love. I find now that students, and we get very fine students indeed at Duke University, I find that students more and more are tending to write stories that have no visible relation with their own experience whatever. They try immediately to write science fiction, desert island stories, long ago and far away stories, army stories when they've never spent a day in the army. I strongly suspect, and I hate to turn into the kind of bore who blames television for everything, but I think we are dealing now with young people whose imagination has been completely handed to them by network television with all of its limitations of censorship and commercialism. And it's very difficult to jolt these students out of their canned imaginations into some sense, some realization of what few things in their own past may be of real urgency to them, may be of such intense curiosity and importance for them that they might need to consider those in stories.
Well, it takes an effort to read a book. It's an effort for me, and I've been reading all of my life, and I usually read 2, 3, 5 books a week. And yet sometimes I'll pick up the book and say, boy, I don't know if I have the energy to pick up this book. It's much easier to put on a video.
Of course it is. And I love movies as much as anyone who ever lived, and I watch a fair amount of television. But I also never saw television until I was 21 years old. Just hadn't been available in my part of the country until then. And I'm very glad it wasn't, because I was allowed to develop imagination that arose out of my relations with the world, out of my relations with my family and my friends, and out of my relations with a tremendous amount of reading that I did from the age of 7 on, the age of 6 on. I'm terribly afraid that we've got a country of children now who've been deprived of an opportunity to make an education. I think the worst thing that happens to children who are reared by television is not so much the quality of the television itself, is the terrible danger is the passivity that it enforces upon their minds. We all know that sort of gooned out look of the television child who just sits there with mouth open and wide eyed. And in fact, if you'll notice a child who's reared that way, he goes on to become a man or woman like that. They are absolutely hypnotic the moment television is turned on. It can be the worst kind of furniture commercials in the world, and they're still sitting there with mouth open and eyes gaping, trapped by the eye in the room.
And yet, the television audience is getting smaller. There are so many things to do. I mean, there are computers and there are Walkmans and video tape recorders and FM radio and all of that stuff. It seems to me when I was growing up, we had 78 records, and we had the Saturday morning movies, and we had books, and we did have the radio.
Yeah.
But now there's so many options that people have.
I think you're right, and I think, as a matter of fact, there are very helpful signs in American publishing. People are reading more books. The baby boomers and the yuppies really are buying and reading serious books. You mentioned the book of short stories. It's now on the Times list. There's a new novel, The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, which is a perfectly good first novel, that's now turned up on the Times list. More and more people have found out that they've bought one rock record too many, or seen one Monday Night Football too many, or one dumb situation comedy too many, and are ready to do something else.
Well, just to wrap things up, go back to your creative writing class. How does that work exactly? Do they do anything they want in terms of writing, and then it's critiqued?
They work in the classic way that writing classes work. They write, and we talk about it. I also try to write along with them and let them talk about my work, which they find it difficult to do because they're afraid they'll offend the teacher. But the thing that lately, because of this sort of canned imagination problem that I've mentioned, the thing lately that I try most to do is initially to get them in touch with some material, not necessarily autobiographical material, but some material in life which really interests them and which really has aroused their sense of mystery and curiosity and urgency. try to jostle them out of their desire to write one more science fiction story and come up with something that might be of interest. Not that there's anything wrong with science fiction, but...
I think science fiction is a wonderful transitional literature. In fact, it was my basic reading material when I was an early teenager until I began reading Ray Bradbury. And he wrote so poetically and dramatically that it was a cut above all the other science fiction I had read, and in a way that was what led me to more general literature. Yeah. So I think that as long as they're reading.
Absolutely. No, I began reading good children's books. I certainly wasn't reading Leo Tolstoy at age six.
Well, we all start with Raggedy Ann.
Exactly. From Raggedy Ann, and luckily I moved on from Raggedy Ann to reading Treasure Island and The Boy's King Arthur, and I wasn't just reading comic books, though I loved comic books, and they were a very real part of the ladder that led me upward and onward into better and more interesting literature. So I certainly don't discourage whatever a child might read, unless it's vicious, malicious, sex, porn, violence. But I do say that as often as you can remove the child from that extremely passive relationship with the tube, you've done the child a great blessing.
Well, Wells Price, you're certainly an American phenomenon and a terrific writer, and I appreciate that you have taken the time out of your probably very busy schedule to talk to me, and I congratulate you on your recent induction, and Good Hearts is a wonderful book. Thank you very much.
Thank you.